to the people of Baltimore and the demonstrators across America. I heard your call for no justice, no peace. Your peace is sincerely needed as I work to deliver justice on behalf of this young man.
And with the voice of Baltimore prosecutor Marilyn Mosby from back in May, we begin a three-city call-in on race and justice from St. Louis Public Radio, WYPR Baltimore, WEAA Baltimore, and WNYC in New York. Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer from WNYC. Hello to everyone in our three metropolitan areas, which have all suffered through the traumas of the deaths of Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, and Eric Garner, respectively, and the sometimes tragic aftermaths of those traumatic killings, including street violence in Ferguson and Baltimore, and the assassination of two police officers in New York. Eric Garner died in police custody in New York City 1 year ago next Friday, July 17th. Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson less than a month later, on August 9th. And really, the nation has been having a more intense conversation about race and justice ever since. So we're doing this call-in special to acknowledge these sad summer anniversaries and to take stock together as three traumatized cities. What lessons have we been learning? What lessons have been learned, and what kinds of progress are yet to come? I also want to welcome those of you listening to other public radio stations from elsewhere around the country. Obviously, race and justice are not concerns only in St. Louis and Baltimore and New York, and we appreciate your interest. We have many guests coming up, including Baltimore's Public Safety Director, Stephanie Robinson, the Governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, who announced some grand jury reform today, Black Lives Matter activist Ray McKesson, and more. There is news today, too, as Baltimore Police Chief Anthony Batts was fired, news that just broke 3 hours ago. But the heart of this special is a call-in, and that means you. And my question is, what has changed in the year since Eric Garner died, and what needs to change next? So Black and Latino residents in all three cities, and of course in Ferguson and other suburbs, we want your voices. Police officers, we want your voices. Let's talk to each other a year later. Let's listen to each other a year later. What's changed in the year since Michael Brown and Eric Garner died, and what needs to change next? Our phone number is 1-800-543-2543, 1-800-543-2543, or use the hashtag Radio Talks Race on social media, hashtag Radio Talks Race, or the phone number 1-800, then just count it down, 543-2543, 1-800-543-2543, in Baltimore, in the St. Louis area, in New York. Police officers, after this intense year, what has changed about your job and your ability to keep your city safe? We'll talk to a former Baltimore cop and a sergeant's union leader later. I know many police officers feel aggrieved and unfairly tarnished as racist. Call and tell us. How is it different to be a cop in America today than a year ago? What's changed in the year since Eric Garner died on the force? And what needs to change next? 1-800-543-2543. Police officers, we invite your voices. And community residents, after this intense year, do Black lives matter today in your neighborhood more than they did a year ago? Have police community relations improved in your neighborhood or your city or on your own block? Has civilian crime gotten better or worse? Residents, what's changed in the year since Michael Brown and Eric Garner died, and what needs to change next? Residents of Baltimore, New York City, and the Ferguson-St. Louis areas, we invite your voices too. 1-800-543-2543. And while your calls are coming in, let me introduce my partners for these next 2 hours. Joel McCord, news director of WYPR Baltimore. Roberto Alejandro from WEAA Baltimore. He's also a reporter for the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. Rachel Lippman, courts and public safety reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. And WNYC host and legal analyst Jamie Floyd in New York. Good evening to all of you.
Hello.
Good evening.
And here's something that's changing. Here's something that's changing. The Baltimore police chief. So I have to start on the breaking news here. Police Commissioner Anthony Batts I guess, was told that he would be leaving this afternoon. Tell everyone what happened and why, Joel.
Well, it was quite the surprise. For a number of weeks, the mayor has been saying that she's completely supports Commissioner Batts. She has every confidence in him. And all of a sudden, around 3:30 this afternoon, we get press releases showing up in our inboxes that say Commissioner Batts has been relieved, that that the mayor is replacing him with the Deputy Police Commissioner, Kevin Davis. And it's been quite the surprise all the way around. She said this afternoon that that unfortunately Commissioner Batts had become the focus of all the complaints. He had become the focus and a distraction, which led her to decide that we need to get back to, or the police need to get back to fighting crime and not worrying about the commissioner.
Roberto from WEAA, how much does this flow from the death of Freddie Gray in police custody as a failure of leadership, or from the riots or disturbances in response to Freddie Gray's death?
Well, I mean, I think what's really at issue here is that this commissioner, in light of all of those events, has really, I think, lost the confidence of both the community and of the police department. There are many folks in the police department who feel like he hasn't really defended them with the vigor that they expected. And there's a community here that just feels like he has not achieved the reforms that he was brought in to do. And I think more than anything, and perhaps probably the biggest issue being that he's sort of lost the respect of the troops that he's supposed to be commanding, to the extent that it's even led to a work stoppage seemingly here in the city, is what really led to his ouster.
Rachel from St. Louis Public Radio, heads have rolled in Ferguson, too, haven't they?
Not in the same way that the head is rolled here, in the sense that most of the individuals named and cited in the Department of Justice report, the Patterns and Practices report, were allowed to resign. The municipal judge resigned. The Ferguson police chief resigned. The city manager, sort of the administrative head of the city, had resigned. So in that sense, yes, heads rolled, but not in the same way as someone being fired. No, I believe there was one individual, a court clerk or a court employee, who had sent racist emails documented in the Department of Justice report, who was actually physically fired as opposed to being allowed to leave.
So people resigned in Ferguson. People have now been fired, or the police commissioner has been fired in Baltimore. But Jamie, in New York?
Well, in New York, we have a hashtag that is New Yorkers Against Bratton. But so far, he's held on. And, you know, the response here has been quite different. That is not to say there hasn't been quite a bit of tension in New York between the police commissioner and the various chiefs and the community in the wake of the Eric Garner death a week ago next Friday, Brian. But we had a very different response. We had a lot of peaceful protest, and we had a mayor in a bit of crosshairs here, Bill de Blasio, who called it, quote, a painful day in New York after the grand jury decided not to indict last December. So we've been reeling quite a bit with the other cities with whom we're on the phone tonight and on the air tonight, but a different series of events, and I'm sure we'll do a lot of comparing and contrasting as
Indeed.
Well.
Indeed. In fact, the prosecutor in that non-indictment of Eric Garner, of the police in the Eric Garner case, just got elected to Congress.
Yes, in fact, he is in Congress, Mr. Donovan. And that issue of Mr. Garner's death was not an issue in the election, not made an issue by his opponent, and did not come up. But race, not very much an issue at all out there on Staten Island for either candidate in that congressional race.
In the press conference today, where Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake announced she has decided to replace Anthony Batts as the Baltimore Police Commissioner with Deputy Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. Although she had been supportive of Batts' efforts in the past, she was asked why her support suddenly shifted, and here's what she said.
It is clear that the focus has been too much on the leadership of the department and not enough on the crime fight. It is with the utmost urgency that we get the crime surge under control, And when the focus is on repeatedly on the leadership, on, you know, who supports the leader, who doesn't support the leader, that's attention that we're all taking away from the essential work that we all have to do together, which is in with collective impact and with unified resolve focused on making our city safer.
So the mayor of Baltimore, and let me ask you, Baltimore people, and really in St. Louis too, since there's been change there, though in a different way, in Ferguson, can we say that new leadership suggests a new way of approaching police work and approaching the community? Roberta, what do you think about that? Because she said in that clip that the focus on the leadership has been a distraction, but maybe when the leadership changes, the approach changes, and that's part of what is needed.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, from the perspective of just being here in Baltimore, I find that statement by the mayor to be a bit confounding because, you know, I sat down with Commissioner Batts last Thursday for an interview, and he spoke a bit about the new leadership that he's brought into the department since he got here in 2012. And, you know, his point was, look, I'm trying to change the culture of a department. And this is a department that for a long time has been seen as abusive towards residents and has driven this problem in the city. And so that requires new leadership at the top. And this move to replace him now with this interim commissioner, Kevin Davis, seems to be a step backwards because Batts was brought specifically for the purpose of reforming the police department. And Davis's experience in neighboring counties here, Anne Arundel County and Prince George's County, is some cause for concerns because those are two counties whose police departments have really bad reputations when it comes to dealing with African Americans.
And so, Rachel, in St. Louis, since the theme of our show here tonight is what has changed in the last year, as well as what still needs to change, does change at the top in Ferguson suggest a new way of approaching police work in a city where police work was found to be so troubled?
It's very hard to say whether or not there has been a change with the interim chief coming in. He's in there until they find a replacement. He is a veteran police officer, but had not been with the Ferguson department for very long. I think he came on a week or two before Michael Brown's death back in August. There seems to be a lot of just waiting to see what the Justice Department is going to do with the results of its report, if it's going to be some kind of a consent decree, if there's going to be a negotiated settlement there. You've seen a lot of change within the municipal court system, which was cited in Ferguson as also being an element of just oppressive law enforcement in the community. But in terms of the police department, other than the resignation at the top, it's hard to get a sense as to whether you're seeing individuals being ticketed less, whether you're seeing fewer of the racist practices and targeted towards African Americans that you were seeing with the Ferguson Police Department, and that were documented in the report.
All right. Residents of the New York, Baltimore, St. Louis areas, police officers there, what has changed and what needs to change still after the year that we've been through, 1 year now since Eric Garner and Michael Brown both died last summer in the hands or at the hands of police. 1-800-543-2543. 800-543-2543, or use the hashtag on social media, Radio Talks Race. Gary in St. Louis, you're on the air. Gary, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you for having me. I wanted to raise an issue to your panel in regards to economic change. And I know that a lot of what's been in the media and the action that has been taken has been towards changing police policy, which I'm sure needs to be done. But I wonder if there's anybody out there that's getting less attention that's going after economic change for the areas of poverty in the cities that we live in, which has, you know, more or less caused, you know, the type of policing that we're seeing today. And we'll have maybe a longer, better effect, a more positive effect on the people who are being persecuted.
So you are going right to the ultimate root causes. Let's go all the way from policing, which is, you know, Jamie, maybe the capillaries of, you know, poverty and hopelessness to the root causes of poverty. You hear that in the conversation enough?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think we talk very often about race because we can see race, but we don't talk as often about class. And clearly there's an intersection of class and race, and we're not as comfortable, I think, talking about class for all sorts of reasons that you and I have talked about before, Brian, related to these cases that we're here to talk about tonight and related to other issues. And clearly, there cannot be a lack of coincidence between the recent economy and what we perceive to be an uptick in these incidents. I actually don't think that there is an uptick in these incidents. I think what we have is an uptick in perception because of social media, and I'm sure we're going to get into that. But to get back to the caller's point, there is a sense of despair in some communities, I think, that leads to a greater willingness to express our resistance when these incidents happen. And then you have the overlay of social media that allows people in other communities that perhaps are not in despair to see what is going on. It takes us back in some ways to what happened in the 1960s when television came into the civil rights struggle and allowed folks to see what was really going on down south when you were safely up north, not realizing what was happening.
And the new conversation about police behavior plays in, not that it's new, there's always a conversation about police behavior, but the intense focus in the last year plays into the conversation that was already going to be defining in the next presidential race about inequality in general, to the caller's point. And this is another expression in many people's minds of inequality, the kind that ends in violent death. And so, again, the root cause, the poverty, the inequality, tying to individual behavior and police behavior. Let's take another call. John in Illinois, across the river from Ferguson, he says. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing? I agree with the panel somewhat, but the root cause is still race. I'm old enough to, matter of fact, participate in riots back in the 60s and read the stories and stuff. And if you remember, I think it was a Warren report, you know, just about every riot, all the riots we had, Watts, Chicago, whatever city, it was all caused from police murdering black people. And if the example, if the Justice Department have the nerve, which I think they don't, because I think the racism is from the top all the way down to the bottom, if they had the nerve to really go and investigate policemen's computers and look at their websites, and look at their affiliation with the Klan and skinheads and other racist groups, that would help. But I told the person that talked to me when I first called, the problem is extreme racism in the criminal justice system from the very top, from the FBI all the way down to the bottom. And my first initial comment was, and I'll repeat it, is it is not going to change in a year. It's been, 50 years, whatever, since the riots in the 60s, and the situation still has not changed.
And, John, I'm gonna cut you off only because we have to go to a break, but police officers out there, take that as a challenge. There are many Johns from Illinois out there who think that there's such systemic racism. I know you bristle at that. Call us up, 1-800-543-2543, 1-800-543-2543.
First and foremost, we are a nation built on the rule of law. And so we need to accept that this decision was the grand jury's to make. There are Americans who agree with it, and there are Americans who are deeply disappointed, even angry. It's an understandable reaction. But I join Michael's parents in asking anyone who protests this decision to do so peacefully.
From WEAA and WYPR in Baltimore, WNYC in New York, and St. Louis Public Radio, This is a three-city call-in on race and justice in this summer that's 1 year after the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. I'm Brian Lehrer at WNYC with Joel McCord, news director of WYPR Baltimore, Roberto Alejandro from WEAA Baltimore. He's also a reporter for the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. Rachel Lippman, courts and public safety reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. And WNYC host and legal analyst Jamie Floyd in New York. And listeners, keep calling us from all three cities. And remember, we are especially inviting both police officers and resident civilians from high crime or high police presence neighborhoods. What has changed in the year since Michael Brown and Eric Garner died, and what needs to change next? 1-800-543-2543, or use the hashtag Radio Talks Race on social media, hashtag Radio Talks Race. Now, one big issue in both the Eric Garner and Michael Brown cases was the non-indictments of the police officers at whose hands they died, as just was reflected by President Obama from that clip last summer. People even called for an end to the grand jury system. Well, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced a reform today intended to restore some trust in the justice system by removing many killings by police from local jurisdiction and giving them to the state attorney general in New York, Eric Schneiderman. I asked the governor to explain what's new here just before we went on the air tonight. One of the issues in both Ferguson and New York is the outrage over the non-indictments of the police officers involved in the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, has now announced a new policy intended to help make sure grand juries and prosecutors get these things right. The state attorney general, Eric Schneiderman, will act as a monitor in such cases. We're glad to have with us for a few minutes Governor Cuomo. Thanks so much for coming on, Governor, and tell us what's new here.
Thanks. My pleasure, Brian. You know, we've been talking about this for about 20 years. I think it's come to a head now. When you look at what's happened in New York with the Eric Garner case, et cetera, and when you look at cases around the country, there tends to be a common denominator, which is a lack of trust in the criminal justice system, primarily from some minority communities, because they believe there's a double standard, and they believe that justice is supposed to be blind. It's the great statue with the blindfold, and it's not blind, that the relationship between the prosecution, the DAs, and the police is too close, and that the DAs can't be objective because the DAs work with the local police department day in and day out. Now, in terms of a conflict of interest, there's two concepts. One is a real and actual conflict, and one is the perception. I don't believe necessarily that there's an actual conflict. I believe we have some great DAs, especially in this state, but I see the perception problem. And we're now at a critical juncture, Brian, where we're really losing trust, and it's getting worse. And our move today says let's remove those cases where a police officer kills a civilian and the civilian is unarmed. Let's remove them from the local district attorney and give them to the state attorney general in New York, Eric Schneiderman, because the AG, I'm a former attorney general, the attorney general's office doesn't work with the police on that intimate a basis.
So you don't believe that there is an actual conflict, either between prosecutors and police or in the way they present to grand juries, and you're doing this purely to appease the perception?
I am saying you don't have to get to the question of actual conflict because the perception is enough. If there is the perception of a conflict of interest, that is enough to justify this act.
Last question. To look at the big picture that this program is looking at tonight, what do you think has changed in the last year since the deaths of Eric Garner and Michael Brown, and what more do you think needs to change?
I think we are in a negative situation that is now, there's a negative synergy. People are seeing a pattern, and the pattern is repeating and reinforcing. Everyone has now a cell phone camera, so we're getting video of situations that we would have never seen before. The Eric Garner case in New York was disturbing. You look at that video, you are disturbed. And what you've seen in Missouri, what you've seen in Baltimore, what you've seen in Cleveland, they're reinforcing. I think that's the bad news. It's been getting worse, not better. I think what we did today is a major reform and a recognition of the problem. We had Eric Garner's mother with us. We had Sean Bell's mother with us. And they said for the first time, essentially, they think justice was done and a reform was put in place that maybe their loved one didn't die in vain and maybe it stops. And this is, it's possible to turn the corner, but it is going to take real action because this is a serious problem, Brian, and it's not going away on its own.
Governor Andrew Cuomo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And with us next is Baltimore's Public Safety Director, Stephanie Robinson, appointed in March by Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake. Ms. Robinson, thanks very much for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good evening. Thank you for having me.
And obviously the big news today is that Police Commissioner Anthony Batts was fired in Baltimore. What can you tell us about why that was?
I will say, first of all, we are very appreciative of what Anthony Batts brought to Baltimore. The situation was this. He in that role was just a distraction, if you will. There were too many people, both internally and externally, that were concentrating on the person as opposed to what is the goal of BPD and of the mayor. By BPD, I mean Baltimore Police Department and the mayor, which is to continue for this city to be safe, to keep it safe for all of its citizens. And so with that said, the mayor had to take decisive action today and did so, but it is with appreciation for the efforts that Anthony Batts has brought to Baltimore to date.
One of your jobs has been with the mayor's working group on police body cameras.
Yes.
I know. What kind of a program are you implementing?
Well, with respect to the body-worn cameras, everyone here in Baltimore wants body-worn cameras. I think that across the nation you're going to find that police officers, citizens, government authorities, everyone agrees that overall it's a great idea. What was done here was a lot of consideration was put into not just bringing them, but in terms of actually implementing a successful program. So currently, there are bids being accepted for the program, and they will be reviewed. And we are very much looking forward to having a pilot program strong and moving forward before the end of this year and having body-worn cameras in Baltimore on a larger scale in 2016.
How much do you think that body-worn cameras can reduce unnecessary police violence?
I think body-worn cameras is going to do a lot, just in general. I think it's going to provide an opportunity for both police officers and citizens alike to have a recording, if you will, some kind of record of interactions. I think just it's human nature for everyone, whether they're citizens or police officers, to be aware that the body-worn cameras are there. And I think that it's going to help in the interactions between police and the community. I think everyone is sincerely on board with having them because the expectation is that they're going to be a benefit to all.
One other thing. New York is going to a community policing model.
Mm-hmm.
That'll give cops a third of their time on the job to build relationships and do other foundational work to get to know the community in pursuit of crime reduction. That's a third of their day freed from radio calls. They say they want it to be a national model. Are you looking at that or anything like that for a path to reform in Baltimore?
I think that that is, from what I gather, and I know it's just been announced today, but it sounds like a fantastic concept. I won't go so far as to speak to what Baltimore will specifically do. As you know, we've just appointed an interim commissioner, and the day-to-day operations are not mine alone to make or the mayor's. But I will say that the police department here is committed to community policing. Already, officers are engaged engaged more so out of their cars. They're walking their beats every day and getting to know the citizens on a totally new level. And the mayor and I and the interim commissioner are all in full support of community policing. I don't think there can be a successful model of policing in any area today without incorporating those ideals.
And by the way, something's not working because crime is going up in Baltimore since the spring, right?
Crime is going up. I will say specifically violent crime, and that was one of the considerations the mayor had in making her decision today because, again, efforts were being diverted and concentrated on things that were not geared towards continuing this city being a safe one for its residents and for people coming into it.
Do you have a problem of a demoralized police force after the indictments in the Freddie Gray case? Reluctant to be aggressive as they need to be to keep crime down?
I will say there's been a lot of speculation with respect to that. There are people, I would say perhaps the union, because they've made that position clear, the
right.
Fraternal Order of Police for Baltimore Police Department.
But you're the public safety director. You should have an opinion on that,
and
right?
I do. The rank and file I've spoken to are committed to good policing. And I think that we all recognize that everyone has a role to play in terms of criminal justice. The state's attorney's office reviewed the justice system will play out. The officers are presumed innocent until proven guilty. And I think everyone accepts that. And what will happen will happen. But officers overall, the rank and file here in Baltimore, are committed to good policing. And they will continue.
All right. Baltimore's Public Safety Director Stephanie Robinson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's a three-city call-in on race and justice in this summer that's 1 year after the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. Our public radio stations in Baltimore, St. Louis, and New York joining here for this tonight. And Mary in St. Louis, you're on the program. Thank you for calling in.
Yes, thank you. You were questioning what are some of the changes that have happened in the, over this time period.
Uh-huh.
And if I can speak of locally here in St. Louis, the new, I guess, associations and alliances that are being formed between people who've till August 9th never had anything to do with one another. And when I speak of that, I'm speaking of artists, people of different races, ages, their, you know, whether they have a criminal record, things like that.
So you see hope. You see hope in people coming together in a new way.
Well, that level of engagement does come out of hope. I mean, protest is a form of hope, and that's definitely what we are, I guess, ultimately. But this isn't a kumbaya time. We haven't come to that. To speak in kind of like metaphors of like peace and harmony. We're not there. But the engagement between these communities has had some effects. And one of the ones that needs some still great reform here, and reform may involve throwing the whole system out, that's the municipal court system in St. Louis. We have, I want to say, over hundreds of municipalities, and they each have their own courts, their own rules, their own laws in their community. And people of color and poor people in St. Louis, poor and of color, intersect quite correspondingly.
Right. Most
and
places
often,
in America.
Yeah, exactly. And so, this weekend there was an individual that I know of who was jailed for municipal violations. And it was just prior to the 4th of July weekend. And he was picked up in the city of St. Louis on a traffic, a car violation.
And you're saying a person of color, and that might have not resulted in an arrest if the person had been white?
I'm not asserting that in this particular case, but the entanglement that this person has in the legal system because of their non-criminal but municipal violations. Think of, if you own a home, you might leave your garbage can out too long.
Right.
If you drive a car, it might not be registered.
Right. And Mary, I'm going to move on, but I think that that is one of the underlying factors in many of these cases. Eric Garner, all he was doing was selling cigarettes. Michael Brown, people will say all he did was shoplift. And you can, you can go on from there. But thank you for raising those points. And we go from Mary in St. Louis to David in Baltimore. Thank you for calling, David. You're on the program.
Yes, thank you. Because the person was a shoplifter, or because the person was going to get a bag of Skittles, or because the person was selling cigarettes, does that mean that that person has to die brutally by the people that are supposed to protect us in this country?
Obviously not. Shouldn't mean it. Shouldn't.
Now, the thing I wanted to say is Mayor Rollins may have fired the police chief, but she may have also fired herself by doing that. She messed around and let the Fraternal Order of Police turn her into a puppet. And this is what they're going to try to do to all politicians in Baltimore City, because this is a racist city. It's an inner white circle that wants to kill black children, okay?
David, that's such a strong statement. You're saying...
I have a right to speak, right?
You do have a right to speak, but I have a right to follow up and ask you a question. Do you really think they're out to kill black children intentionally?
Well, what do you think they've been doing, sir? What do you think they've been doing? They were police officers who killed these children. Okay? There's no way to dress this up. And it's going to be a whole lot of stuff going on in the days and weeks to come, depending on these trials that's coming up. We got 5 or 6 different trials coming up where police officers have killed children. And if they don't go properly, then we're all going to be in trouble.
David, thank you for your call. And before we go to a break in a minute, let me get a quick response to those last few callers from Roberto Alejandro at WEAA in Baltimore. Hearing people coming together in St. Louis, but David there in Baltimore, at least from his particular point of view, sounding like things are very polarized.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that things are pretty polarized. And, you know, I think part of the problem is that the simple truth is in this city, there hasn't been a real commitment to community-oriented and community-based policing. Batts was brought in for that purpose. He is now being let go, essentially because the local police union didn't appreciate his efforts to reform in that direction. And so one of the issues here, and I think what is informing that last caller, is that the community has a very different idea than the police about what community policing looks like, and it's not the cue that the mayor is taking right now.
It's our three-city call-in on race and justice in this summer that's 1 year after the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. We'll continue in a minute.
And with Dante, very early on, with my son, we said, look, if a police officer stops you, do everything he tells you to do. Don't move suddenly. Don't reach for your cell phone. Because we knew, sadly, there was a greater chance it might be misinterpreted if it was a young man of color.
And with the voice of Mayor Bill de Blasio from WEAA and WYPR in Baltimore, WNYC in New York, and St. Louis Public Radio, this is a three-city call-in on race and justice in the summer that's 1 year after the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. I'm Brian Lehrer at WNYC with Roberto Alejandro from WEAA Baltimore. He's also a reporter from the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. Joel McCord, news director of WYPR Baltimore. Rachel Lippman, courts and public safety reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. And WNYC host and legal analyst Jamie Floyd in New York. And listeners, keep calling us from all three cities. And remember, we are especially inviting both police officer and resident civilian voices from the high crime or high police presence neighborhoods. What's changed in the year since Michael Brown and Eric Garner died? and what needs to change next. 1-800-543-2543. Just count it down after the 1-800-543-2543. Or on social media, use the hashtag RadioTalksRace. Hashtag RadioTalksRace. With us now is former Baltimore police officer Peter Moskos, now a professor of law and police science and criminal justice administration at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. He is also author of the book Cop in the Hood. And we have the president of the New York City Sergeants Benevolent Association, Ed Mullins. So, Sergeant Mullins and Professor Moskos, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Professor Moskos, as a former Baltimore police officer, what do you think of the firing of the police commissioner today?
I'm thrilled. I think it's a good first step. I don't think anything could have gotten better until he was gone. He had simply lost the support of the rank and file, and that's all the rank and file. He wrote an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun going after the Vanguard Society, which is one of the African-American police organizations, which was both misguided and politically foolish, but he simply needed to go. He was a bad leader.
If he lost the support of the rank and file and that's why he went, is that a bad omen for the protest or reform movement because the police union has too much power relative to others? He was brought in as a reformer.
He was brought in as a former, but I don't think he should be counted as one. He didn't have a great track record, and he brought in a lot of ideas that perhaps applied to Oakland, but simply didn't work in Baltimore. He was obsessed with gangs. Baltimore's got a lot of problems. Gangs probably isn't on the top five.
Yeah.
His approach to the riots, I think, was influenced by anti-police action again on the West Coast. Baltimore is a different history. He never seemed to grasp that. He cut and run wherever he went, and I thought he was going to leave as soon as he could claim some victory in Baltimore, but I'm unfortunately kind of pleased to see him go earlier.
Sergeant Mullins, what do you think has changed for your members in the years since Eric Garner and Michael Brown died? How different is police work today?
I think police in the NYPD has become reactive rather than proactive. We are seeing these demonstrations and incidents that are occurring across the country, and there's a message of policing being too aggressive and people not being interested in the enforcement of what they call the broken windows crimes. And ultimately, there's a message that's being sent to police officers that's one of confusion. And I think we've seen that probably the most in the city of Baltimore, where, you know, the residents were burning down stores and buildings and really destroying their own neighborhoods. And we had supposedly orders for the police department to stand down from getting involved. So when you see that type of message that's come out and it's viewed nationally and internationally, we're now seeing spikes in crime, violent crimes. I mean, just today in New York City, we had a 21-year-old male carrying his baby shot in the head. We saw that happen in Chicago over the weekend. You know, there's a great message of confusion as to what the role of law enforcement is. No one wants bad cops. No one wants people violating anyone's rights. And that's clear, I think, on both sides of the aisle.
And I think we're at a point where both residents and police officers are feeling aggrieved. Much of the community thinks there is too much aggressiveness by police officers for minor things, whether it's reactive, and as in the case of broken windows policing, or proactive, as in stop and frisk under Mayor Bloomberg in New York. And disproportionately in minority communities, of course, the feeling is that people get arrested for things they don't in white communities. And the officers feel unfairly tagged with distrust and suspicions of racism, as, for example, we heard from an earlier caller. How would you describe the morale of your members today?
I think morale is down. I think that, you know, we see an NYPD that is out doing their job. You know, there's all this fear about terrorism over the 4th of July weekend. We had 7,000 police officers out in the street and nothing happened. So, you know, they're doing the job, but I think they're doing it with a lot of uncertainty. And I agree that there is a common bond between the people in a community who are looking for a softer police department, and is the message of confusion. You know, as you know, we have an outside monitor, Peter Zimmeroth, a highly respected individual, and in meetings that I have had and come to understand some of the things that are occurring, people in poor neighborhoods actually want the police in those neighborhoods. They are asking for more police because they're afraid. And ultimately, I believe they're the silent majority who are too afraid to come out and go public with the call for police because they're living in high crime areas. So we need to find that common bond where we can, you know, give them a voice and be able to protect them in a process.
But Sergeant, there is a perception, and studies seem to back this up, that there's a fair amount of unintentional systemic racism on the part of many police officers. There have been double-blind studies that show there's a tendency to see black people who are otherwise acting, you know, identically to white people as more threatening. Do you acknowledge that's a problem?
The same studies, however, showed police are less susceptible to that. That was mostly the public at large.
Peter Moskos, go ahead.
The police are better trained. I'm not saying that there aren't problems, but that specific problem, the studies have showed that police, because of their training, are more likely to accurately perceive threats when they should.
You also have to take into consideration, and, you know, okay, there's studies. In any field, there is going to be people who are racist. They're going to have racial profiled views. We're going to see that. But if you look at that study and we take a look at the Baltimore Police Department, that is broken down to be 50% African-American members, from what I understand, and I may be off on my numbers.
No, it's 50% non-white. It's a smaller percentage African-American.
Okay, but you have a pretty diverse police department and a predominantly African-American city. And you have an African-American mayor, an African-American police chief, an African-American district attorney. So then how do you explain the breakdown for the alleged racism that's being claimed in the Baltimore Police Department? Now, what I always attribute a lot of this to, on both sides of the aisle, is education. Because in the world that we work in, we have complainants make reports. And who do they report as the perpetrators of crimes? Generally young male blacks. If you look at the statistics, the police don't go out and identify who the perpetrator is. We don't get to pick and say, tomorrow I'm going to identify a 6'4" male white with blue eyes. That's provided to us by the victim. So you then take that, and you can understand why a public would sit back and create the perception that police officers are looking at male blacks from a racial perspective.
Professor Moskos, I saw you wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post saying that police officers themselves see the New York and Ferguson cases very differently from the North Charleston, South Carolina incident where a cop shot a fleeing man in the back. Why so different?
The North Charleston, South Carolina case really shocked police officers because it was indefensible. A cop shot an unarmed fleeing suspect in the back. It is exactly what those who have been attacking police say happens a lot. Cops, myself included, are saying, actually, though there are individual problems, we see that as a smaller problem than crime in general. So that was a real – it was painful to see for everyone. It was very different because in the Michael Brown case, which he wasn't just shot for shoplifting. He was shot, as the Department of Justice said, because he was fighting a cop for his gun. That's a very different case. So if we want to pick a martyr for the movement, unfortunately, there are plenty to pick from. But that case was absolutely different.
Although many civilians see the North Charleston incident as merely the most egregious end of the spectrum of, let's call it, inadvertent racism in how they see the threat from black suspects compared to white suspects, why not see these incidents as different points on a problematic spectrum rather than wholly different?
Because one sees police officers as the problem and the other sees police officers as part of the solution. There is a lot of gray in policing, and there are a lot of justifiable shootings. But even some of those shootings that are legally justifiable doesn't necessarily make them morally justifiable. Different departments have incredibly disparate rates of police-involved shootings. So even though when bad things happen in New York City and it's fair to criticize those incidents, perhaps we should be looking to the NYPD for best practices, because the New York City Police Department shoots a small fraction of police departments in other cities and other states. I don't know why in California people are six times as likely to be shot by cops as they are in New York, New Jersey, or Michigan. There's better and worse out there. So instead of saying that all police are the problem, let's try and look at what the solutions are.
It's our three-city call-in on race and justice for St. Louis, Baltimore, and New York in this summer that's 1 year after the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. And let's go back to our phones. Ernest in Baltimore, you're on the program. Hello, Ernest.
Yes, I'm a retired Baltimore City police officer.
Uh-huh, thank you for calling.
Had more than 25 years of service. Drove the wagon for 15 years with no incident. Now, in reference to Peter Moskos, Peter Moskos was a Baltimore City officer. I think he had 6 years on.
Oh, not even. Less. Huh? I wasn't even there for 2 years.
Okay. So you can't know about the vanguards. I was in the vanguards. And most African-American police, we
hated. That's the Black Police Association?
Right. The Vanguard Justice Society. That this president of Vanguard Justice Society was standing with the FOP in this particular incident in reference to Freddie Gray. The reason why the Vanguards was started, it was because of racism and white supremacy in the Baltimore City Police Department. And what made it worse, they sent a police commander down here, Ed Norris, with that zero tolerance stuff, locking up people for minor things and causing trouble. That was the start of our problem.
Yeah, and it's ironic that he ended up in prison, too.
Yeah, he's a convicted felon, just like Kirk. Now, the thing is this. People in Baltimore City, African-Americans, want to be treated like other people. I mean, when you get called to the scene, here you hear unarmed man shot. All the police in Baltimore City had to do was when Freddie Gray said, I can't breathe, I have asthma, is to call an ambulance and take him to the hospital, not handcuff him and throw him in the back of that wagon. And first of all, they haven't even accepted Freddie Gray and his condition at men's detention.
And Ernest, I'm going to leave it there, and I very much appreciate your voice, and I want to throw your question to Sergeant Mullins, the president of the Sergeants Benevolent Association in New York City. In the Eric Garner case, was it a failure of the sergeant not to tell the officers to stop compressing his chest when he was thoroughly subdued and kept saying he can't breathe, or, as the caller points out, to call for an ambulance immediately when he went unconscious?
Well, an ambulance was called for. If you look at the video, it showed up immediately on the scene. We also saw two EMS workers.
Or have them give him CPR immediately themselves.
Once an ambulance is called and the ambulance responds and they're on the scene, they now render medical aid. And if you look at that video closely, the two paramedics that responded checked his pulse and went back and got a gurney and rendered no aid in that video. Eric Garner was saying he could not breathe. Now, you don't provide CPR to a person who is breathing. When you are speaking and saying, I cannot breathe, you are actually breathing. Now, what you're doing is sending a signal that your breathing is changing. But when that happened, an ambulance was called for. EMS personnel responded. What took place after we see that video en route to the hospital, I wasn't there. You weren't there. You know, we have an ME's report that I've never seen ever written where it was classified death by choking or chokehold or whatever it was they labeled it for. So we had a lot of politics that was in play. At the end of the day, Eric Garner, as any individual that's out there in the field and gets arrested and ends up dying, is not a target of the police. Those officers didn't come to work that day saying, let me go kill a male black, get myself indicted, and be on a front page of every national newspaper. They went to do a job, and when there was resistant arrest, and we've been seeing a lot of that across the country, we see incidents where people are you know, being arrested, and it's growing into further violence. We just saw one a week ago where a police officer ended up boxing with an individual in the street because he refused to be arrested, and he had two warrants on him.
Can I ask you both to react briefly to the reform that Police Commissioner Bratton is trying to lead in New York that takes officers off of radio calls for a third of their shifts to do longer-term crime fighting by building non-emergency relationships with community leaders and other residents? Peter Moskos, how much do you think that's the avant-garde of policing going forward?
It's so old, it's new. I'm anything that gets cops out of cars, I'm supportive of. Police too often are just slaves to the radio, jumping from one call to another. And a lot of those calls don't even deserve to have police service. The public's been sold on the 911 system of call and response, and it sucks about half the police department, police that could be out there interacting with citizens, police that could be doing proactive police work. But I support that move. But there is one thing that always people never seem to address, which is, look, non-criminals should like the police. The police should be working for those citizens. But at some point, police have to deal with criminals. And if the sweet lady going to church likes or doesn't like police, and I hope she does like police because the police treat her with respect and do their job, but at some point, that's irrelevant to the criminal class. There are criminals out there that cops have to deal with, and that goes a little bit beyond community policing. There is something coercive about the job, and we have to talk about that as well.
But in theory, the idea is they're not just going to be softer, they're going to be learning more about the roots of crime in the community by talking to people and learning, you know, systems and maps and algorithms and, you know, not just responding
help
to this spot because there's a radio call in that spot.
Yeah, and it'll help police learn what makes cities work. It'll help make police officers appreciate the city. Too many police officers don't live in the city, have never lived in the city. I understand why cops often want to leave because of the job, but it's important for cops to understand, look, there are 8+ million people in New York who love this city. Police should be a little more on that same game plan.
Sergeant Mullins, we have a minute before a break. Are your sergeants rolling their eyes at this reform, or are they happy?
I think we're looking at it as it's a step, but personally, I've been through this step over the last 30 years. It's called community policing. There's pros and cons to it. At the end of the day, you have to win the hearts of the people you serve. And being out there in the street and walking a post and talking to people, yeah, you will find some information out and some people will like you. But we're not winning the hearts of people as a whole. Every precinct has community affairs offices already. They deal with the community boards. They deal with the city council members. We need accountability up the food chain, too, that when things happen, we need, you know, leadership in city council to stand up and say, you know, this is exactly what happened.
New York City Sergeants Benevolent Association President Ed Mullins, former Baltimore police officer Peter Moskos, now with the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and author of the book Cop in the Hood. Our three-city call-in on race and justice continues.
Since Ferguson and the task force that we put together, we have seen too many instances of what appears to be police officers interacting with individuals, primarily African-American, often poor, in ways that raise troubling questions.
From St. Louis Public Radio, WIPR and WEAA in Baltimore, and WNYC in New York, this is a three-city call-in on race and justice in the summer that's 1 year after the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. I'm Brian Lehrer at WNYC in New York with Rachel Lippman, courts and public safety reporter for St. Louis Public Radio, Roberto Alejandro from WEAA Baltimore, Joel McCord, news director of WYPR Baltimore, and WNYC host and legal analyst Jamie Floyd in New York. And listeners, keep calling us from all three cities. And remember, we are especially inviting both police officer and resident civilian voices from high crime or high police presence neighborhoods. What's changed in the year since Michael Brown and Eric Garner died, and what needs to change next? 1-800-543-2543, 1-800-543-2543, or use the hashtag RadioTalksRace on social media, hashtag RadioTalksRace. The newspaper Guardian USA is doing a year-long series called The Counted, as they count every individual killed by police in the United States in 2015. They counted 547 as of July 1st, projecting a total of 1,100 to be killed by police in the United States this year. Of those 547, 478 were killed by police gunfire. Blacks are killed by police at twice the rate of Latinos or whites. And of the 547 killed by police, 546 were male. John Swain from The Guardian joins us now. John, welcome to the program. And with us also is Yale Law Professor Tracy Mears, also a member of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. Welcome to the program, Professor Mears.
Good evening.
John, why is The Guardian counting like this, and what do the numbers mean?
The reason we're counting is there is no comprehensive count in the U.S. The federal government does not keep one, which I think comes as a surprise to many people. The FBI runs what is closest to a comprehensive count, but it's voluntary, and so law enforcement agencies around the country, if they want to, can submit numbers of homicides that were carried out by their officers. And what results is a very partial, very bitty picture, which is just not satisfactory. And we thought that this issue is so prominent, it's so important in the public debate at the moment, that solid data, that at least the numbers that reflect the scale of this issue, are needed.
Professor Mears, only a handful of these 547 police killings, even though the number is shocking when people hear it for the first time and never thought about what a number like that might be, only a handful have become public controversies. Are almost all the rest uncontroversial in terms of not much of a question that they were justifiable?
I think that's an interesting question. I mean, non-controversial probably legally. I think it's fair to say that if you look at most police shootings, they are consistent with the law in the books that allows police officers to use deadly force in situations in which they have reasonable fear of their own life or that of others, and in certain contexts. I think justifiable in terms of how the public sees it, though, is a different question. And I think that's one of the issues that we tried to tackle on the president's task force.
John, have you put these numbers in historical context? Channeling our guests from the previous segment, who are present or former police officers or police sergeants, they might say, well, one of them did say that it's much better in New York than it is in some other cities in terms of the rate of police killings of civilians. And my guess is they would say that 50 years ago, police killed at a substantially higher rate, that there was less restraint in the use of force. So even though the country is inflamed about this issue now, it's actually much better than it used to be, not to make these particular incidents okay. But do you happen to know, how are you putting your numbers in historical context?
Well, what you say may be true, but the frustrating thing is we just can't know because there has been no comprehensive count. There have been amateur crowdsourced counts done for recent years, I think for the last 5 years or so. They have tended to count around 1,000, around 1,100 per year, which has been more than twice the number counted in that voluntary FBI program that I mentioned. And so this is the problem, you know, and this is a problem that we attempted to address by tackling this with a more comprehensive database. It's so frustrating that we can't put this in a historical context. And obviously, as you say, activists, protesters often say that things are worse than they have ever been, that the police have steadily increased their mistreatment of young and often African-American communities. But we just don't know, and I think that's a real shame. And we hope by implementing this project of our own to try to move things along. And so in doing so, start creating a context. In terms of the city question that you mentioned, what we found is that, much to the surprise of some people, I think, New York is fairly good among major metropolitan areas. Los Angeles, for example, is experiencing this year a far higher rate of police incidents that lead to people's deaths. Chicago is also pretty good in terms of the if we're comparing the major cities. And so, you know, I think they're in these numbers. This is something that we've tried to draw out. This is not necessarily a database that only activists and protesters will point to as proof that they are in the right. I think there are numbers here that certain police departments around the country might be able to point to and say, look, we are, you know, behaving well, we're policing appropriately, and these numbers show it.
And Professor Mears, you've spoken about reviewing even justifiable police killings to see what the opportunities might have been earlier in the incident to defuse the situation and not get to that point. Can you give me an example or two?
I can, and also can build off of the conversation you were just having with John about historical data. He's absolutely right that we don't have a national register, so getting a national picture is difficult. But I do think that there is some value to looking at the voluntary FBI data, especially with respect to big cities, and looking at their historical records. And if you look at those data, even acknowledging the fact that many of them are incomplete, I think the record shows that, especially in many big cities, the situation is getting better. And you can see that by looking at a couple of cities. So, for example, in New York in the 70s, there were many civilians killed in car chases, and the New York Police Department made a decision to change its policy regarding, you know, chasing people in cars. There's a police executive research forum report about this, and deaths of civilians from police action were cut substantially. Similarly, in Las Vegas, there was an examination of the use of deadly force there. The police chief there implemented some strategies of de-escalation, the kinds of things that I was talking about, looking at what decisions can be made earlier at an earlier point in interactions with folks, and they've had some successes.
Tracy Mears, Yale Law Professor and a member of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, and John Swain from The Guardian USA. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
It's our three-city call-in on race and justice in this summer that's 1 year after the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. 1-800-543-2543. 1-800, then count it down, 5-4-3-2-5-4-3, and let's go back to our phones. Cheryl in St. Louis, you're on the air. Cheryl, thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. I guess the thing that I would say, I guess first I should say I live about 5 minutes from Ferguson. I've lived in the area for quite some time, and actually participated in some of the marches and so forth. So very intimately involved in what's going on in the Ferguson and St. Louis area. You asked what had changed and what had stayed the same. And so for me, I would say in St. Louis, the thing that has changed is that people are starting to at least be able to have conversations about race and racial relations. Whereas in the past, in St. Louis, if you brought up anything about race, it was deemed by the white citizenry that you were playing the race card. You know, why are you bringing that up? Why can't we just all get along? You know, that type of thing. And even some of the African-American citizenry said the same thing, because everybody wanted to, you know, try and pretend like we were post-racial, I guess. Okay. So that has been something that has started to change, and we have some organizations like the YWCA and others that have really, you know, taken a leadership role and have made it a point to provide forums for people to talk, to get to know people different than themselves, and to really explore their own personal, you know, values and biases and thoughts, if you will, about
what happened. So it's your sense that this tragedy in Ferguson and the particular focus on police is opening up that larger national conversation that we need to have about race in general.
Most definitely. I definitely think that it has. The one concern I have, however, is that I think people are really kind of sidestepping the real issue. And in St. Louis, the real issue for me, in my humble opinion, really centers on education. And in St. Louis, education is very uneven. Children of color oftentimes are receiving a subpar education. I happen to be a person of color. I'm not originally from St. Louis. I am a mom of two daughters. I'm a public school graduate, but chose to send my children to private schools because the district that I reside in, which happens to be the Normandy School District, which is where the St. Louis NPR station began, mm-hmm. is an unaccredited district. And so, you know, when you have a university literally sitting in the middle of a district that is unaccredited, and then you have Washington University, which is on the Metrolink line, and St. Louis University, which is also on the Metrolink line in either direction from this unaccredited district, and all of those institutions are building teachers, okay, there's a larger problem. People have made choices not to deal with something that is really huge mm-hmm. in our community.
Cheryl, thank you. Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Russell in Durham, North Carolina next. Russell, you're on the program. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to go and add something, I guess, possibly a different perspective. One of the things that I see happening, I am not of the opinion that things have changed. I think we are now dealing primarily with things have actually gotten worse. But I'm very much, I think, of the opinion that this problem is cyclic. And I go back to what we saw happening. I wasn't around then, but what the history talks to us from the Kerner Commission report. The Kerner Commission report, which was done, I think, in the late 60s, talked primarily about how there was this centralization of poverty. And you saw how poverty was being localized within various inner city neighborhoods. And when you saw that taking place, then you also saw a lot of the marginalization taking place, also with police and police misconduct that was being done to a large degree with impunity. And so with the report on civil disorders, one of the main things that came out from that was that there was a need to actually reinvestigate or open up a lot of the questions that you saw happening, again, with black people being black and poor people being targeted by police. Now, what I see happening or I saw happening in 92, 91 with Rodney King, again, you had the same thing happening. But again, the problem was not really a real issue, part due to the fact because you did not have that much media exposure. So now you do have social media, and we're in an environment where it's hyper media mm-hmm. saturated. And so I think because you now have people who have smartphone technology, it allows a lot of people now to actually see the realities that a lot of people, the majority mainstream culture, were, for lack of a better term, were aloof to. So when you see what happens with Eric Garner and how you have the policies of New York and stop and frisk, or when you saw what happened with the gentleman in South Carolina who was gunned down, were it not for video, and even then were it not, even though you had video in the case of Eric Garner,
there was still no indictment. Were, right. Russell, I'm going to leave it there and move on. Thank you. And let me go back to our panel and Rachel Lippman, criminal justice reporter at St. Louis Public Radio. The last two callers identify, I think, two related things that have changed. The caller from St. Louis said that she thinks that the Michael Brown incident and the focus on police has pried open the larger issue of race in America and has people all over talking about it in a fairly productive way and a broader way than they were before. And one of the reasons it's pried open is because, from the last caller, everybody has cameras on their phones, and suddenly there's a window to the outside wider world into what goes on in inner cities, primarily in police community interactions some of the time. What do you think?
I believe that the caller from St. Louis was right in the sense that you do have conversations focusing around these issues in informal and formal settings. There was you'll have a member of this commission on later, a commission that the governor started to look at policy changes in a number of different areas, not just policing, but areas of economics, as an earlier caller spoke about, economics of education, as Cheryl spoke about. So you do see people willing to have the conversations about the topic. The question is whether conversations at a level of individuals in the community does anything to influence the policymakers, the police chiefs, the educators, those who are actually empowered to make the decisions that essentially, and the policy decisions that dictate how governments, police, etc., operate within the context of these communities.
So Patricia in Fanwood, New Jersey, in the New York City area, wants to build on that, I think. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks.
I feel the real problem here is that white people tend to only view black people as thugs and drug dealers. They don't look at us as professional doctors, lawyers, teachers, of such. And that's how they see us. So it's like, yeah, I can deal with you at work, but I'm not going to invite you over for dinner. I'm not going to have you at my barbecue. I really don't want to get to know you. It's great that, you know, white people feel, oh, we're trying to be, you know, together as people, but they really don't want to get together because they only see us in a certain way.
Do you need to get that invitation to the barbecue in order to have justice?
No, to start a dialogue. Say, I'm just like you. I struggle just like you every day to pay my bills, to make sure my kids are healthy, and just to be alive. I have the same problems as you. The color of my skin doesn't really mean that I'm that much different than you. I have the same struggles, you know? I get up every day, I go to work, I do what I got to do to survive and make sure my family's taken care of.
So you're not convinced by the African-American woman caller from St. Louis that we're having a more productive set of racial interactions in the last year?
To a certain degree, yes. But it's not enough, because you can say one thing in the office or out in public, and then when you go home, you're going to say something else. You're going to do something else. You're going to say, well, I really don't want to interact with that person because, you know. And it's not a real conversation unless you kind of invite people to the party, so to speak.
Patricia, thank you so much.
Well, and Brian, I'm going to jump in and say the most important thing is that you're going to think something else in those moments of crisis.
That's Jamie Floyd from WNYC, and this is our three-city call-in on race and justice in this summer that's 1 year after the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. We have St. Louis, Baltimore, and New York together, and we'll continue in a minute.
We just want to have a normal life. That's it.
I guess it's hard to have a normal life after someone is lying dead.
Mm-hmm.
Something you think that will always haunt you?
I don't think it's a haunting. It's always going to be something that happened.
You have a very clean conscience.
The reason I have a clean conscience is because I know I did my job right.
Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson, after not being indicted in the death of Michael Brown, with George Stephanopoulos on ABC, and from WEAA and WYPR in Baltimore, WNYC in New York, and St. Louis Public Radio, this is a three-city call-in on race and justice in this summer that's 1 year after the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. I'm Brian Lehrer at WNYC with Joel McCord, news director of WYPR Baltimore, Roberto Alejandro from WEAA Baltimore, Rachel Lippman, courts and public safety reporter for St. Louis Public Radio, and WNYC host and legal analyst Jamie Floyd in New York. Listeners keep calling us from all three cities. What's changed in the year since Michael Brown and Eric Garner died, and what needs to change next? 1-800-543-2543, 1-800-543-2543, or use the hashtag RadioTalksRace on social media, hashtag RadioTalksRace. With us now, DeRay McKesson, well-known activist, organizer, and member of the group We the Protesters, and St. Louis community leader Brittany Packnett, executive director for Teach for America in St. Louis, active in the protest movement, and the youngest member of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. Ms. Packnett, Mr. McKesson, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having us.
DeRay McKesson, a year after the death of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, has anything changed for the better in your opinion or for the worse?
Yeah, I think that there's now a national focus on race and policing in ways that weren't happening a year ago. And people have acknowledged that the police are killing people and that they shouldn't be. And that is something that we fought so hard for in the beginning, and that we finally gotten people to accept that there's a crisis happening.
There's been a change in leadership in Ferguson itself. How much do you think that will result or is already resulting in better policing, Ms. Packnett?
You know, I think that leadership changes are important, but what's much more important and what I'm thankful that we're continuing to see is the marriage of disruptive action leading toward hopeful systemic action. And so this idea that we see see in places like Selma in the mid-century civil rights movement, where activists took to the Edmund Pettus Bridge and they took to peaceful disruptive action in Selma, Alabama, but also took that fight to the halls of Congress, to the White House, to the policymakers and the folks who are continuing to maintain systems, that we have to continue to see both of those things happen at the same time. And so we have to be thinking bigger than one leader or one police chief or one mayor, and we have to be thinking about entire systems that have continued to keep people in systems of inequality and inequity, and actually figure out how we are going to allow disruptive change to move us towards systemic change.
Ms. Packnett, how much do you accept the grand juries and the U.S. Justice Department's non-indictments of Officer Wilson, whose voice we heard a moment ago? The conclusions based on the credible witnesses seem to be, according to them, that Michael Brown had tried to get the officer's gun, was moving toward him, not away from him at the time of the shooting, did not have his hands up, and did not ever say, hands up, don't shoot, though that's become a mantra of the protest movement. Could it be that protesters were right on the big picture about Ferguson, as the Justice Department then reported on, but wrong on Darren Wilson?
You know, I think that I don't actually respectfully, I would dismiss the premise of the question, because ultimately we are talking about a situation on August 9th that was not the first and clearly has not been the last incident in which a young person of color, a young African-American man in particular, has lost their life. Regardless of the details, I think that we can all agree that a life lost for whatever Michael Brown did or didn't do was actually incredibly unnecessary. And the over 500 lives that have been lost this year alone are people that should still be continuing to walk around, continuing to support their families, continuing to enjoy their lives. And so I want to make sure that we don't get focused on trying to find the perfect victim or the perfect situation and ignore the systemic issues that continue to leave people dead in the streets.
So systemically, DeRay McKesson, how much do you think we're at a moment of historic national change in this year since Michael Brown and Eric Garner died that perhaps makes you optimistic about real progress toward racial justice in America? How much?
Yeah, I'm really hopeful, right? And hope is a belief that our tomorrows can be better than our todays. And what is important about the space that's been created is that people now understand that the police are not infallible, that while they do good work and have a role that can be important, that they also commit crimes and that they are not wholly off the hook for their actions. So we've seen with Walter Scott, you know, with the video with Walter Scott, the police did everything in that video wrong that they said that they never do.
That was the South Carolina case where a police officer shot a man in the back as he was running away, unarmed.
Yep, and they lied about it. It was the cover-up. Like, everything that the police said never happened happened in that video. And it's those moments that are important for people to see that, like, the police lie and actually not held accountable in ways that make sense. So I think there is an opening. I think that people are starting to see that structure and the system needs to change. I think that there'll be a focus on police contracts soon. I think that there'll be a focus on laws. I think there'll be a focus on, like, the culture of policing changing, too, with things like training, body cameras, with special prosecutors, as we saw in New York State today with that announcement. So I do think there's space for it. I'm also sensitive that we will not undo hundreds of years of oppression in 300 days. So, like, people are in this for the long haul in terms of peeling back the systems and structures that oppress people and that lead to the untimely deaths of so many, especially so many people of color.
Ms. Packnett, how do you think the police accept that something was wrong systemically in Ferguson before the Justice Department report that showed how high a percentage of Ferguson residents have been arrested at one time or another, and the revelation that Ferguson uses the police to raise money by cracking down on residents, and the other findings. Do you think that report is accepted by the local leaders now in a way that will make life there different?
I think it's becoming to be continuously more accepted, and reports that are existent in many other cities are really starting to shed light on this issue. But we can't dismiss people's lived experiences whether or not they're included in a report. And so, again, this importance of disruptive change and people making sure that they are amplifying their voices on social media, peacefully in the streets and in other forums to ensure that those stories and those lived experiences aren't lost, that is becoming what we are seeing is kind of awakening people, right? And so I think that I have had the honor to interact with people from all backgrounds that, if they weren't aware before, are certainly aware now. And I'm hopeful that this conversation that we are now having about explicitly about race will eventually turn into space where we require knowledge and skill for people who hold positions of authority in communities on issues of race and bias. It's one thing just to talk about it. It's another thing to actually require the people who hold authority in our communities to act up in unbiased ways.
What will the protest movement, what will the protest movement do next, Ray McKesson? What are your next goals?
You know, I think that so much of the first 10 months were about exposing and convincing. It was saying, hey, the police are killing people and you need to look at this. You need to believe us. And that was so much of what we were doing. We were shutting things down. The protest, disruption and confrontation was about exposing and convincing. I think that now we will be shifting into a phase of thinking about what solutions look like in terms of changing structures and systems. We also know that the strategies that we use to expose and convince will be different than the strategies that we use to solve, right? That we will engage different strategies in this moment. And that I think that people right now are taking a step back and saying, what does it mean to win? And how do we get to those wins, knowing that there will be a complex set of wins that will not just be body cameras, it will not just be a special prosecutor, it will be all of these things working in tandem with each other. So I'm hopeful that the protest space will continue to disrupt and will continue to confront and will offer really thoughtful policy, politics, and cultural solutions about how do we weaken racism and its impact, and also make sure that police don't kill people, because we can live in a world where the police don't kill people.
And with our protest leader guests, Brittany Packnett and DeRay McKesson, we bring back in former Baltimore police officer Peter Moskos, now a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York and author of the book Cop in the Hood. Have you been listening to our guests over the last few minutes?
Yes, I have.
Any reactions? Can we find common ground here?
There might be some common ground. I think, look, America's got issues, historical and current, systemic issues with racism and poverty and also crime. We need to address those issues, mental health issues in particular, that police officers have to deal with that should be dealt with in another matter. We shouldn't, however, use police officers as somehow representative of all this historical and evil in America. At some point, we need to stop telling police what not to do and tell them what to do. That's why cops right now feel they're in such an awkward position, because they simply don't know what is acceptable anymore. Of course cops shouldn't shoot innocent people. Police will tell you that, too. But the question is, what do we do with the crime that's out there?
Who wants to jump in?
Well, I think the response is really easy.
Everyone wants to jump in. Go ahead, Ms. Packnett.
No, well, first of all, I would agree with DeRay. And I would say that one of the first things that we need to do is stop denying reality, right? The Equal Justice Initiative actually just put out a really great video under the hashtag Slavery Evolved that very clearly connects the dots between this transatlantic slave trade and American slavery to mass incarceration and the systems of criminal justice today. And so if we continue to allow people to operate within a system, as proprietors of that system, without completely educating them and ensuring that they face the reality that, yes, they are working in a system that many people for many centuries have very good and justifiable reason not to trust, then we are allowing people to get off the hook. When we think about the fact that public servants derive their authority from the people, continuing to be accountable to those people is absolutely and fundamentally necessary at all times.
That's all true, but what should a police officer do when the resident calls and says, I want drug dealers off my stoop? So the cop pulls up, now what? We should end the drug war. That's one possible solution.
If I could finish, one of the things that we need to begin with, again, is that education piece, such that police officers are operating with respect in the communities that they serve. Creating the kind of trust and legitimacy that allows them to do their jobs. When we actually think about the kind of policing that happens in schools, another thing that we can do is actually create really positive interactions for young people and police officers instead of highly punitive ones, where oftentimes young people of color are having their first negative interactions with police officers in schools. So there are many solutions here. And if you look at the police, the task force report, if you look at Mapping Police Violence and We the Protesters, if you look at some of the work that the Ferguson Commission is doing right now, if you look at nonprofits and organizations and grassroots activists from around the country, we've presented lots and lots of solutions. And so I'm not going to agree with the premise that the solutions aren't out there. It's a matter of whether or not we're going to take them seriously.
The societal solutions, I think you're absolutely right on. But it still doesn't help the line officer on the street who gets a call and has to deal with a criminal. I'm not disagreeing with your other points, but at some point there's a real issue of cops having to interact with people. I don't see solutions for that.
That's like so easy, right? You are essentially saying that, like, you know, if they kill people because they aren't trained any better, then like that happens. And that is exactly what you suggested, this idea that, like, they are interacting with people, and in that interaction, that this might just be an outcome. And, like, that just isn't okay, right? That, like, they didn't need training not to beat that girl in McKinney, Texas. Like, I will not accept that there could have been better training for that. Like, they should have actually just made a different choice. And they made a choice that they should be held accountable for. And it shouldn't have taken 15 more hours or any new course in training not to manhandle a girl in a bathing suit.
Absolutely. The young woman at the swimming pool in McKinney, Texas, you're referring to. This is Jamie Floyd. I think we have to acknowledge that being a police officer is a tough job, that they face a real danger. At the same time, officers are required to maintain their professionalism and composure. And we have to acknowledge that we're locked in a tragic feedback loop, and that we're repeating a past that is mired in racism and that our country is refusing to this very day to address. And we need to, I think, start taking advantage of the decline in crime to make a distinction between criminals and people who are not engaged in crime, so that when these encounters occur, we don't encounter each individual citizen, especially when they have brown or black skin, as a criminal.
Let me bring another caller into the conversation. Tom in Manhattan, you're on the program. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. What I've noticed, I've lived in New York City my entire life. I'm in my 50s. I'm a doctor at a local hospital here. I live in the upper west side. What I've noticed is a disintegration in race relations to the point, I believe, it's not been this bad in New York since the 70s. And I think that partially to blame is, unfortunately, our mayor, who has sort of whipped up race relations into the worst state they've been in for three decades. As a further note, I've taken care of many cops at night and during the daytime. And, you know, as I said, I've lived in New York since the 70s, and I mean, with due respect to your experts, I mean, what kind of society do these people think they'd be living in if there was no police force? You know.
Well, I don't think anybody's calling for no police force. But DeRay McKesson, do you want to engage the caller?
Yeah, I take offense to this idea of these people. Right, that is again language that like hints to a mindset that's really unproductive. But I will say that like we've been seduced to believe that more police are like essential to a crime prevention strategy, and they are not. Crime prevention is based on like healthy neighborhoods, strong schools, grocery stores in places. Like more police don't actually stop crime; they move crime. So, like, we have to, like, be more creative when we think about crime prevention strategies. And, again, police officers do have hard jobs. Like you said, black people have hard realities living in America, too, right? That it is not simply about, like, how hard something is. We are making excuses for people who are choosing to kill people and excuses for the system that are not holding them accountable. And that's just not okay.
Peter Moskos?
It baffles me to still hear today that police are irrelevant to crime reduction. Of course police matter. But there's a long strain of that. Some of it stems from the civil rights movement. If you see police as racist agents of oppression, of course you want fewer police. But police do affect crime. After the riots in Baltimore, because of changes in policing, the murder rate literally doubled overnight.
There were no riots in Baltimore.
Well,
what do you call them?
The uprising, maybe?
Oh, that's so sweet, but it's really patronizing to those that actually with agency cut fire hoses and loot stores. But that's a difference we'll have to accept. But after the riots in Baltimore, the homicide rate doubled.
Can I chime in here, Brian? Because the murder rate in Baltimore was skyrocketing before Freddie Gray died.
That's Roberto Alejandro from WEAA. Go ahead, Roberto.
Yeah, so
it was up about, 30%?
Yeah, but the point is both shootings and homicides were well ahead of last year's pace before Freddie died.
It went up
after the riots, that pace simply continued.
Well, that's not quite right, but...
And let's not forget that as things get warmer, especially in places like Baltimore City, things get more violent.
Yeah, murders went down last month. Now, see, all those are tried and true cliches, but they don't reflect the reality of what we're seeing in Baltimore or America.
Ms. Packard, we'll give you the last word before our break. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. So I think reality is the perfect word. Number one, let's deal in reality. Number two, if we're dealing in reality, we need to be careful about phrases like these people, right? If we're going to have sensitive conversations on race, then we should do it accurately. Thirdly, I do not believe that I heard DeRay say that police don't play a role in society. What I heard him say is that the root of issues of crime and oppression and poverty are not solved by police. They're solved by other systems. And so we have to allow a real look at actually examining how we take oppression out of those existing systems.
Thank you all three. And our last caller from Manhattan. It's a three-city call-in on race and justice in this summer that's 1 year after the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. For St. Louis, Baltimore, New York, we continue in a minute.
This would appear to have been a chokehold, but the investigation, both by the district attorney's office as well as by our internal affairs, will seek to make that final determination.
New York City Police Commissioner William Bratton, after the death of Eric Garner, and from WEAA and WYPR in Baltimore, WNYC in New York, and St. Louis Public Radio. This is a three-city call-in on race and justice in this summer that's 1 year after the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. I'm Brian Lehrer at WNYC with Joel McCord, news director of WYPR Baltimore, Roberto Alejandro from WEAA Baltimore, Rachel Lippman, courts and public safety reporter for St. Louis Public Radio, and WNYC host and legal analyst Jamie Floyd in New York. And listeners keep calling us from all three cities. What's changed in the year since Michael Brown and Eric Garner died, and what needs to change next? 1-800-543-2543, 1-800-543-2543. And let's go to our next caller, which is Diana in Baltimore. Is it Diana? Did I say your name right?
Yes, Diana.
Diana, hi.
From Baltimore, and I'm very optimistic for change, and so are some of my peers, well, most of my peers. So we've been a part of this awesome organization called the Inner Harbor Project, and in this project, we have a youth-led training for officers to bridge the gap between teens and them in Baltimore. So that's what we're doing, involving change, and we've developed the training as teams. Like, we did it from research that we had and focus groups, and it was a lot of work. But and we recently finished with the Lexington Monkey Unit, and in our training we have a pre-test and a post-test, and on the post-test the officers scored like 100 across the board. And also we have
What's the most important thing that you think this youth training imparts in the police officers? What do they learn from you guys?
They learn communication, empathy and respect. So basically they learn how to talk to youth and how to like go back instead of being like that authority figure that they come off as.
Thank you so much, Diana. Good luck with it, and I'm glad you're optimistic. Agnes in the Bronx, you're on the program. Hello, Agnes.
How are you doing? I don't know where to begin. My fire is lit from so many burners here. Nothing has changed here in New York. Nothing has changed. And this problem, as we call it, it's a national struggle, and we know it. We know it. Now, I don't know what Poppyfield Mullins walked through before he got here, but to say
the
that...
The leader of the Sergeants Union in New York City, an earlier guest,
Right, yeah. He didn't answer your question when you said, why didn't the supervisor of the Garner case tell them to stop compressing his chest? He didn't answer that, but he went on to say, well, look, they called the EMS, and the EMS didn't wait on him. I mean, again, kick the can down the street, but the bottom line here in New York is stop and frisk has wreaked havoc on the black and Latino community, and we're no longer accepting the trust me, I feel you, your pain, new community cop. Let's have a meeting, because, no, we've already met. And the systemic change that has to happen is a dismissal. No one's talking about Kyle Gurley.
Of who?
Well, no one mentioned the Kyle Gurley. That's the kind of policing that comes in. Police have to recognize that, just like the man in the Upper West Side.
There is an indictment in that shooting, though, right? The Brooklyn DA and a grand jury did indict the police officer in that shooting of in a public housing stairwell of a Kyle Gurley.
What was the first thing that was put out? It was a tragic accident. That was not an accident when that's the type of policing that is sent in.
Does it not give you more hope, though, that there was, after the initial response was looked at more closely, in an actual indictment of the police officer?
How many have been indicted? Now, the other thing that's historical, earlier in the program you spoke about, you know, the count, people were going around getting a national count. If you remember historically, that's what Ida B. Wells was doing in the anti-lynching movement, right? She had to go around and get the count, and so that we can prove that there's a pattern. Mm-hmm. And we're running around now trying to prove again that they're a pattern. Well, we're not surprised anymore.
Right.
We're not. Again, every new lynching, every new killing by a rogue, a Zimmerman or a roof down there, or unaccountable police are no longer surprises.
Agnes, I'm going to move on. I get you. Thank you very much.
I just want to say one more thing.
Go ahead.
Don't cut me off. Okay, we have the Johnny Gamage case, okay, and that law almost went through to have a special prosecutor. We already have laws on the books that call for forbidding racial profiling. You have the Department of Justice, you have the New York State government, you have the Attorney General, you have the Division of Human Rights. You have all these laws in place, and still you put the architect of broken windows in charge.
Police Commissioner William Bratton. Agnes, thank you very much. Arlene in St. Louis, you're on WNYC. Hello, Arlene.
Hi. Thank you very much for this program. I live in St. Louis, Missouri, in a suburb called University City, which is probably about 5 miles, 4 or 5 miles southeast of Ferguson. But the issues that we have cut across much of our St. Louis County. First point I'd like to make is that I think it's crucial that independent prosecutors must be appointed whenever there's use, lethal force in particular, but use of force by a police that injures a civilian. There's absolutely no way that a prosecuting attorney, for example, here in St. Louis County, who knows all the police because he has to use them as witnesses in various cases, can be unbiased and objective in deciding whether or not charges to be brought or how to present the charges to the grand jury. So I think that that's one reform that's desperately needed throughout the country in any states that do not have an independent prosecutor statute.
Great. Arlene, thank you very much. And so let me go to Rachel Lipman, courts and public safety reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Rachel, Arlene from St. Louis brings up the need for an independent prosecutor in these kinds of cases. We heard earlier in the program from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who took a big step in that direction for New York State today. He said any case involving a police shooting of an unarmed civilian or a civilian who it's disputed whether the person was armed or not, that case is being taken away from the local prosecutors and grand jury and being given to the state attorney general. After Ferguson and after the non-indictment, is there any serious discussion of something similar there, as Arlene is calling for?
You've seen it presented in the legislature in bill form, mostly by Democratic state senators and representatives from the area around Ferguson. But the dynamics of Missouri politics are such that you're unlikely to see a Democratic governor, which we have right now, take the step to do that. There are basically three sort of blue dots in Missouri running along Interstate 70 in the three main cities, and the rest of the state is fairly Republican and fairly red. So you're not likely to see the governor feel as though he has the freedom to take that step. He can't run for office anymore, but he's term limited out. But you're still unlikely to see him take that step. And measures calling for outside prosecution or outside evaluation of officer-involved shootings did not go anywhere in the legislature, which is controlled in veto-proof majorities, I believe, in both chambers by Republicans.
And Baltimore people, how about that dynamic there? Joel McCord from WIPR.
The dynamic in the city is, I think, different than a lot of other places. And I say that, and you know, let's go back to the caller, David, in Baltimore, talking about the white inner circle. I don't think he's looked at his mayor lately, or the president of his city council, or the majority of the people on the city council.
And the Baltimore City State's Attorney, Marilyn Mosby.
And the city, right. That was the other thing.
Made
I was about
news.
To say.
I mean, and that's what makes Baltimore different from the other two cities on the program today. There was an indictment.
And I think what it comes down to, at least in Baltimore, you know, blue trumps black. That it's a police mentality that needs to change. I know Peter Moskowitz will probably disagree with me, but it's not so much, or maybe Roberto will, it's not so much a question of race in Baltimore as it is a question of the police mentality.
Roberto from WEAA, do you want to disagree with that?
I might take some issue with it. I mean, I do think that it's certainly true that the police hold incredible sway, but I think the racial dynamics of our city government are more complicated than Mr. McCord just suggested. And even if you look at much of the mayor's inner circle, it's largely sort of white upper middle class folks whose policy ideas don't generally land very well in the broader Baltimore community. And so I think that dynamic is a little bit more complicated.
And you had that dynamic in St. Louis and in Ferguson, especially, where it is a majority African-American city in a population base that has changed drastically in about 20 years from a majority white to a majority African-American city that is still still governed mostly by the same elected officials who were there before the population changed. So you had a white mayor, a white police chief, a white city manager. You still have a white mayor. You still have a white police chief. And I believe the city manager, all of whom are temporary except for the mayor, is also still white. So the different dynamics in Ferguson were white political officials, white policymakers governing a black community. You see that in the city of St. Louis as well, where the mayor and his staff are mostly white, governing a, if not majority, 50-50 minority white population.
And there's a class dynamic here, too, in Baltimore, where a lot of the established political class is sort of seen as in helping better off African-Americans in the city, but doing less for low-income African-Americans. And Marilyn Mosby, our new state's attorney, represents a sort of generational shift where you're starting to see a younger class of politicians, African-American and otherwise, but who are very committed to lower-income communities in ways that the city hasn't historically seen.
And Jamie in New York?
The real question in New York and everywhere is whether these ugly encounters that we are seeing represent some sort of tipping point, a transformational moment, or whether, as many of the frustrated callers have been suggesting, this is just more of the same. Are we just seeing the same tradition of Ramarlay Graham and Oscar Grant and Sean Bell, and we heard Rodney King's name come up, and we haven't talked about Amadou Diallo, and I could go back to Clifford Glover. Anybody know him? 1973, 10 years old, Jamaica, Queens, shot by the NYPD. Emmett Till, we all know that name, or we should. So the question is there going to be change, or are we going to go forward to Tamir Rice and Akai Gurley and Freddie Gray and on, and be having this conversation in another 10 years? You know, if you look at the numbers from 2003 to 2009, Just under 5,000 people died while a member of law enforcement was trying to arrest or restrain them. Well, if we talk about 98 million arrests made nationally, that's not that big a number. But if you look at the number itself, well, we could report a different arrest every single day that ended in death for an American citizen. So we have to ask ourselves some very hard questions about whether this is going to be a transformational moment, and where is the leadership that is going to help us transform this from a conversation to real change.
Keep using our hashtag and keep this conversation going all over social media. We see it's been trending in New York and in St. Louis. So keep using hashtag Radio Talks Race and keep talking race and policing. Even when the program ends in a few minutes, hashtag Radio Talks Race. And let's take another caller at 1-800-543-2543. It's Liz in Baltimore. Liz, you're on the program. Hello.
I just wanted to start with, I'm a WEAA listener, so it's really good to hear Roberto Alejandro there on the panel. But I wanted to say that I think, like, and everyone's been kind of suggesting this, but I'm a white person. I live in a white community, but I work with kids who are in the Penn North area in Baltimore. And, I mean, I think the bottom line is white people need to start talking about white supremacy and name it for what it is. It's sort of like when you say patriarchy, people want to change the subject. But, I mean, all of this goes straight back to slavery and Jim Crow, and it's just the same thing over and over again, like folks have been saying. And, you know, if I hear another white person in Baltimore say, well, that's not representative of Baltimore, that has nothing to do with me, and go back to Roland Park, like, I'm going to scream, you know? And I think white people need to start putting some skin in the game, because we need to say that white supremacy is unacceptable, and we need to start working to change it.
And what does it mean to put skin in the game? After you say, as a white person, white supremacy is real and unacceptable, then what?
Yeah, well, one example is, for example, the Confederate flag thing is just a symbol of a bigger issue. But, you know, the guy who was standing at the bottom of the flagpole was a white guy, right? And he got arrested. So, I mean, a lot of it has to do with, you know, in Baltimore, we have a lot of kids that are protesting and getting arrested and doing things in favor of, you know, social justice and racial equality, but white people just aren't doing it. You know, people come and they clean up after the riot and then they leave, and, you know, and everyone's really concerned for like a week and then it dies down. And, you know, and I think that the fact that we had a black commissioner and a black mayor just shows the sophistication of white supremacy. I'm actually taking the words from Davon Love in Baltimore that you know, you can put black faces into a white system and you still have white supremacy mm-hmm. that's being perpetuated.
Liz, thank you for your call. And Colin in St. Louis, you're on the program. Hi, Colin.
Hi, good evening, Brian. Thank you for taking my call and thank you for having this dialogue. I might be able to bring a sort of a unique position to this, to the dialogue.
And do it quick because we have about a minute for you.
Well, I got a bridge between Baltimore and Ferguson. I grew up, born and raised in St. Louis, grew up 2 miles from Ferguson, and I represented the city of Baltimore under three mayors, Mayor O'Malley, Sheila Dixon, and Stephanie Rawlings Blake. And I think what you're seeing is three things happening. The police responding to an era of performance government, new stresses and more acute stresses on communities. And what you're also seeing is people, Americans especially, wrestling with what it means to be American, wrestling and doing a lot of soul searching around their identity and the issue of race. But I think that definitely one of the things that you have to understand, Brian, is there are real stresses here between both the law enforcement and first responder community and communities themselves. You can't reduce the community-oriented policing services account by 40% and not see that have a chronic effect on communities.
And, Colin, I'm going to leave that as your last word. Jamie Floyd, three interesting points from Colin in St. Louis, and I think some of it boils down to change doesn't happen all at once. as much as we would like it to in many cases.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, we do have a unique opportunity here. I referred earlier to what I think is a tragic feedback loop, repeating a past mired in racism that our country has yet to address. This is our opportunity to speak across those difficult, not just racial lines, but class lines. I so appreciated the woman who just called in a few moments ago and spoke honestly about white supremacism. It can't just be a conversation between and amongst black people and communities of color. We have to speak to each other openly and honestly about racism. It's a conversation we have never honestly had in this country, and that's why these shameful incidents continue to happen.
And these conversations are difficult. This program doesn't resolve anything, but hopefully it continues a conversation that Americans need to have in many kinds of forums and in many kinds of places. That is our three-city call-in on race and justice to acknowledge the anniversaries this summer of the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. May they rest in peace. For St. Louis Public Radio, WEAA and WYPR in Baltimore, and WNYC in New York, keep the conversation going on social media. Keep using our hashtag, Radio Talks Race. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer.